Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Now is the time for all good men. W.S. Thackeray interviewing Air Vice Marshal Howsam, 21st of May, 1980. Now, I understand you have some other remarks to make about the Northwest staging route and some of the problems that you ran into in forming it and manning it and with the Americans. Would you like to start at that point?
Yes. These are problems that are brand new to the whole, both to the, well, to the Air Force and to the United States Air Corps. As you will remember, I said that the United States Army engineers built the roadway through Canada to Alaska. And the main road started at a place called Watson Lake, just beyond Dawson Creek. Dawson Creek, just beyond Grand Prairie. And up to there, we had a railway terminus from Edmonton to Grand Prairie and on to Dawson Creek. That was the terminus of the rail and road. From there, the American Army built the new roadway right straight through to Alaska, and it's still in operation today, as you know. Now, to enable the American troops to do their work, they had to have an airline put down throughout the whole of that route, and Canada built the airway, the RCAF, and that's, I think I told you in the last, that was put under my command the minister, Mr. Power, and also my own chief, Air Marshal Bredner, after a very stormy meeting and the telegram.
Yes, I remember. The Canadians actually built the airfields themselves.
Oh, the Canadians.
The Americans didn't do any of it.
Didn't have anything to do with it. And we built it and operated it throughout the war. Mm-hmm. It was called the Northwest Staging Loop then, and later it became the Northwest Air Command. But during that summer of 1942, summer of 42, the everything worked perfectly after we set up a mini headquarters in Edmonton to coordinate it. And I told you about General Billy Foster coming to command the Edmonton headquarters to coordinate the work between the Air Force and the American Army troops. And he did a magnificent job. But the first thing he did to put the V on me to provide him with the staff to do the work. Well, I had to steal them away from my own command, which is very, very thin. But it was so important that I gave him the very best men that I had, and they did a magnificent job with General Foster.
Well, this Brigadier Foster, was he a militia officer that you had?
He had been a militia officer before, but he'd come in. He commanded. The MD-12, I guess it is, in Regina, whatever.
Oh, I see.
12.
Yes.
And that's
mm-hmm.
where I had really met him and got to know him. And I was at Yorkton when he was in Regina, and I'd been in Regina a good bit myself. So I got to know him and liked him, and we worked together as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And he was absolutely priceless in his work. And without him, it wouldn't have gone half as well. So the summer work was going beautifully. The one thing bugging me all summer, where were we going to get the snow compaction and removal equipment to handle all these new air stations? The new air stations that were being built, the Grand Prairie one would be perfectly all right. We could handle the equipment down there by road, by rail, and Dawson Creek. But from there on at Fort St. John's, the next 300 or 400 miles, then Fort Nelson, another 300 or 400, and intermediate landing fields that had to have some kind of attention, because if they had engine failures and so on, the American aircraft going down there in a flood, they just had to be taken care of. So that went right on from right straight through from Fort Nelson to Watson Lake to Teslin to Whitehorse to I can't pronounce this, it's Eskimo, AISIKIKS, I'm not going to try to pronounce it.
And then the next, you can have that one, yeah.
I thought that I could. And the next, our last one, Snag. And that is not quite close to the Yukon-Alaska border. And then, of course, on to Fairbanks, which was in the United States. We didn't have to take care of anything over the Alaska border with the Americans. They look after their own. The next thing, of course, is to assemble a team with the United States to get the whole thing coordinated so that the United States themselves would sieve out their aircraft leaving the United States through proper funnels and direct them to landings in our in Canada, because we had aerodromes everywhere.
All over plenty of aerodromes.
But they had to know where they were going.
Yeah.
And they sieved them into three main sieves, one coming through Minneapolis, another one down in between, I forgot the name of the place, and then the westerly one was Great Falls, the major air bases. And they had good organizational teams there. We set up a group headquarters, small groups, to control the job. And once that was done, the whole thing flowed beautifully.
What aerodromes did they land in Canada? How many? And
well, there were 55 major stations in my command, but they flowed chiefly through the main ones, such as Moose Jaw, Regina, Moose Jaw, Swift Current. These are the southerly ones. Swift Current, Medicine Hat, Lethbridge, McLeod. Then there's a whole flood of them between there and the 100 miles north around the Calgary area, and then another flood between Calgary and Edmonton. But if they were spaced properly, or if they were arranged properly, they went into selected airports. And the great thing was not to overload Lethbridge and Medicine Hat and the first ones that came along. They had to space them, and the aircraft had the range. Why not put them into one?
The same thing happened when they got further north at Edmonton, around Edmonton. They didn't all land at Edmonton Airport, did they?
Chiefly, but they built a new aerodrome there very quickly. Americans did, and it is now the main Air Force aircraft aerodrome in out of Edmonton. The present main aerodrome, military one, not the civil one, the military aircraft out of Edmonton, was built by the Americans during World War II. But the one that we did have is practically surrounded now right in the city. So, but there was no problem after we set up the liaison teams to get together, funnel the aircraft properly to designated routes, and spread the whole thing right across the front. There's no problem. But now the one great problem that did come up was what we were going to do in the wintertime. I mentioned when the snow compaction equipment... There was no equipment available in Canada. It had to be ordered after Pearl Harbor. We were just catching up on our own requirements for our own aerodrome when Pearl Harbor came along. Now, we indented for it. But the indent was all right, but how long does it take the indent to get approved and audible? Mm-hmm. How long does it take to get the United States and get it accepted by the firms that are manufacturing these great snow blowers and road compaction, road rollers, the whole thing, the winter equipment to handle the snow removal and compaction.
It's not the sort of thing that one could just go and buy readily, because the production wouldn't be that great, I suppose, and a sudden demand upon the facilities would build up a backlog. And
same thing, but it happens all the time.
Yeah.
When there's a great demand and there's no facilities... Nobody could foresee the attack in Pearl Harbor.
No. But this was specialized equipment, though, and of course it was the sort of thing that they wouldn't have great stocks of standing around in somebody's some supply depot.
Absolutely brand new.
Yeah.
And so we had to wait. Now, I had, of course, a fair, in my 55 stations, I had a fair amount of our own. And in the autumn months, during the summer months, they repaired it and did any repainting and got it all dolled up ready for the winter jobs. So when I found out through Ottawa that I was not going to get any delivery until about the late November or December. I was absolutely fit to retire because there's one great problem. We could get it down the highway as far as the Peace River, but there's a gap between Dawson Creek and then the Peace River crossing, then Fort St. John. There's a gap there over the Peace River about 2 miles. There's such a bridge to it with its approaches and going down the mountainside and then the high ground down into the river and up the other side. A length of about 2 miles. That's the great bridge. Now, that took all of the next year to build.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they were putting everything in the summer months. They put everything across on well-controlled ferries. They had a couple of good ferries in there, and everyone could get their equipment across pretty quickly. No great delay in the summer months. But when the ice came down in the winter, it took a matter of... We rarely got a very heavy frost in November when the first ice came in. And it took anything up to a month or 6 weeks on that particular year anyway before the ice was heavy enough not to carry an ordinary motor car or an ordinary truck. But these great heavy vehicles, great snow compaction vehicles, and road building vehicles, absolutely fantastic, their weight. And furthermore, the ferries are drawn out. You have to wait about 6 weeks or a month for the ice to get thick enough to put to have a roadway across the river. Well, I couldn't wait that long because during that period it might well be a heavy snow, and every year we did get heavy snow, had done, in my experience. We had to get vehicles somehow across that river before the ice came in. And where to get the vehicles? Well, I had to rob my own stations of some of the spacing it out and get a CO to give up some of his good vehicles that he had serviced. He wasn't a bit happy about it. But anyway, they did. And we assembled 104 vehicles as a convoy. And these great vehicles, I don't think I ever saw a convoy comparable to it before. And I haven't seen one there yet comparable to it. It is a tremendous convoy, and we sent it down in convoy just before the frost came in October. When they got to the really heavy frost, we'd had several light frosts, but not the heavy ones, and we had to get the vehicles across while the ferries were in the water, we hoped. Well, when they got there, the ferries had actually been drawn up, but we had a very good team to go down there and staff work.
These were cable ferries
across the Peace River, and we had a little time in selecting the type of commanding officer we need to handle an expedition of this nature, and it was a special task, and we finally did select an ex-Mountie who had had great experience in the North. That is, I was tremendously keen that he have northern experience.
What was his rank?
He was then, when he came into my office to get his orders, he was an acting flight lieutenant, but I promoted him to a squadron leader on the spot before he left, after he agreed to accept it. The load, I had the authority. I got promoted up to wing commander myself, right on the spot. He was promoted. And he went in as a flight lieutenant, he came out as a squadron leader, with his hands pinned down.
It was all right with him, I guess.
Well, he was pretty proud of it. One feature one characteristic that he had that absolutely sold him over all the others. He had everything else, but he had one more than anyone else that I knew with his comparable qualifications. He was a complete teetotaler, and I wanted a man that would go down there and do the job, but would be able to look after his troops and see that when they were thoroughly wet and cold, which they would get over and over again on trips. There were other rivers to cross as well as the one in the Peace, you know. And I put it to him very carefully about how in my own work in the North, that I'd found that when my troops were wet and cold, if they brew up a good brew, good coffee, and lace it reasonably with good brandy, Then the question was, of course, where I was to get the brandy. Well, the Premium Lanning, when I told him my story, he, Premium Lanning okayed my getting an ample supply of brandy to go with the CEO, who was a teetotaler. Of course, Manning, of course, was a great teetotaler himself.
He authorized this, I suppose, because liquor rationing was in effect at that time.
Oh,
and did he pay for it?
That
was like...
I didn't make Manning pay for it.
You know, he was the okay. Yeah, the authority.
I actually did the job myself.
I see.
Well, you don't send a little boy to do that kind of work. You
didn't. No.
Besides, it's been embarrassing to many.
Yeah.
So, no, I did that job and it was myself. But he took his troops down all the way, put every vehicle from all those stations that I mentioned in place, and didn't lose a man and didn't lose a vehicle. Now, that's a tremendous job of work, beautifully done. And I'll tell you about his orders. I wrote a good operation order, the best I could, how to do it. And before I said, now I'm not going to ask you to initial this copy, I'll show you what I'm going to do with it. And I got up and I just tore it up. I said, now you've got one order. Get those vehicles down there before freeze up. That's one order. To the very best of your ability. I can't foresee all of the things to put in this operation order. I've mentioned my ideas here and my thoughts as best I can. And now here's another copy that I have signed that you can look at occasionally when you want to. But all I want you to do is to get them down there, put them in, look after your troops, and come back in good shape. And he did it beautifully, and I recommended him for an Air Force cross right off the bat, and he got it.
Yeah.
And and then the nasty blow was, Ottawa said, oh, he's much too good for you. We'll take him within about a month. And that's why I lost my man.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Well, that always happens. Well, once you've got a good man like that, he said, oh, he's much too good for you. But he went a long way. But that was the one key thing that made the route work all that first winter. And the Americans, poor people, who didn't have their vehicles either, they didn't have a chance to mark the roadways before the snow came, because man, they built all that road in one summer. How they ever built it in one summer? Of course, they built it on the other end through the Yukon, Whitehorse, up through the railway from the little tunnel of the Royal Railway that runs up to Whitehorse. They built some from that end.
Oh yeah,
but the
way past the Yukon.
That's right. Yeah. Well, they built from that end, but they didn't get very far. The great bulk of it was done through Edmonton. the Americans, not getting their any equipment that they had to put in for themselves until after the ice formed, and then they had a gap of 6 weeks, maybe, or longer. And when the snow did come, it covered up all this brand new roadway. Now, the roadway through the mountains, and round mountain curves and all that sort of thing, and they crossed the Rockies and across the high mountain ranges going between Whitehorse and Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a good bit of roadway that had to be built right through the mountains and around them and all that sort of thing. And the new ground should have been properly marked, which they did do the next year, but it is unbelievable. They built the roadway 2,000 miles in one summer. It's unbelievable, one year.
Yeah, tremendous.
And
tremendous
by them. But they suffered all that winter because the roadways hadn't been marked, and because they were trying to put this much of this heavy equipment down that they needed themselves for their own their own requirements. The Air Force only built the airway and operated them. So we didn't provide any other equipment for the United States. But the United States had to get their own equipment down there. And they did have a good bit of trouble all that winter because their roadways were not marked. The snow covered up the roadway, and you couldn't tell where the edge of the road was or where the, except by the curvatures. Well, then it was about 4 feet of snow. There's no curvature.
Now, your air bases, your airdromes, they were for the benefit of, mostly for the benefit of the Americans flying into Alaska, not for the road builders, but for the...
Oh, well...
Is that right?
This is the Americans, the purpose of the whole thing was the United States after Pearl Harbor, and right up until the end of the late autumn of 42, after the Battle of Midway, there was just no effective force on the United States, on the Pacific. Even in Honolulu, the main base of Pearl Harbor, is thoroughly hammered in December 41. And it took them all that summer, and they didn't know that they were going to get this roadway through in time. And all of the supplies that they were trying to get to Russia, you see, all the supplies for Russia were going, as soon as that was opened up and the airlines was opened up in the summer, that autumn, through the summer and that autumn, the supplies were going through all right. But if the air bases were closed between Edmonton and Fairbanks or Whitehorse, the supplies were just bogged down. And the American aircraft couldn't get through, unless the bases operated to get them through.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing did continue to work despite the weather, and the one limiting factor, the key, was to get that equipment down there before the ice set in, and it was accomplished.
Well, then you got the place, you got it established. And it ran for, apparently, I gather, very well for...
4 or 5 years.
Several years. By 1944, it was transferred from your command, I believe.
Late 44. I had two commands. But in late 44, they set it up as a... By this time, Ottawa had caught up to themselves on personnel and a few other things, and they set up the Northwest Staging Group became the Northwest Air Command. But all the building had been done.
Yes, it was operating organization by the time that they set it up as a separate thing.
Anyway, it took the load off my shoulders. I had a double job, double load.
Yeah, plenty to do without that.
Plenty?
Yeah.
I felt that in the beginning.
Okay. I wondered if... Do you have anything further you'd like to say about this?
I don't know. Truman had some very nice things to say about it.
Yes, I saw your
President Truman,
your citation.
I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but President Truman had to say, and he wrote it on the citation which I have here, and you can see for yourself. Said Air Vice Marshal Hawson, commanding the Royal Canadian Air Force, number 4 command, from June 42 to December 44, rendered extensive material aid to the Alaska Division of the Air Transport Command and the United States Army Air Forces in the operations which rapidly and effectively furnished aircraft and supplies to Alaska and Russia. He not only freely extended needed facilities at a time when those of the Transport Command were extremely meager, but he usually anticipated and met those of particular and essential importance, decisions vitally affecting the operations of the Alaska-Siberian ferrying route were made by him when such action was imperative to prevent delay. Air Vice Marshal Hawson's cooperation in expediting air equipment to far-flung combat areas contributed materially to the successful conduct of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Signed, Harry Truman.
Well, it's very nice to have that, isn't it?
It's better than some of the other kicks I got.
Yeah. Very good. Well, now, by 1943, the BC ATP was working well.
Yeah.
And you had, I suppose you had just about reached your greatest expansion, your greatest number under training about that time, had you? In 43?
By the spring of 44, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We'd already had the original plan was set up in September
1939. Yes, right.
And
it had been increased and doubled.
It had been doubled after Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. by the Air Force. But you see, by Pearl Harbor,
we got our teeth into it, and we were able to survive.
There was never any shortage of volunteers or people who wanted to do these jobs.
No.
Always putty coming in.
Never a shortage of raw material.
Yeah.
But there was definitely a great difference between the raw material that you got in and the ones that you could sift out and train.
Right.
And it took a good time. It took up to very near 2 years to train a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You see. Well, I think I mentioned to you earlier, I'm going to go back very quickly. Some of this here, the summation here, might help.
Summarize.
On September the 1st, 1939, the Second World War began, as we all know. And 2 days later, the United Kingdom and France declared war upon the Reich, and all the way down, and we were in. Now, the conflict did not begin with the great aerial sound shots. We did have a period, you remember, of relative calm from 1939, the autumn of 39, to the Battle of Britain began in the summer of 1940. During that period, that was a great period of grace as far as we were concerned. Now, what we had done from as early as 1937, we decided that we had to have a university staff at the top to set up our school,
mm-hmm.
not only just a flying instructor or a navigation instructor, a nominal instructor, we had to have the university brain that could handle the whole thing and put it together. So we started picking our select men out, that was my job, as a director of training, and sending them to the United Kingdom to be trained. Did I give you this before when we were on the line?
Yes, we had some of this.
Well, I don't want to go too much then. In any case, that is where we got our PhDs and MAs and VAs and so on. Men that, I think I told you that men like Fleming
mm-hmm.
and a few others, Roy Fleming, had three or four, they were specialists in three or four different qualities, different armament, navigation, wireless, a whole bag of tricks, and always, of course, they were specialists in flying. So, but we had to spread that right across the board to cover all the specialist qualifications and have enough of them to spread as the professor people, if you like, in our schools to take care of being well. Our raw material when the war broke out came from the schools, the universities, any number of the universities just flocked into medical people. And then we processed them through our schools and of training. That's where we got our training staff. But we had already set up our top level brains before the war took place. Now, probably you'll be interested in some of these figures. The total trained under the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan in Canada were 131,000 trained air crew to the air forces of the United Nations. As you will know, we had as many as 7 or 8 different nationalities almost on any one parade. First was they coming from within the Empire. They came from Britain. They came from New Zealand, Australia, from all the islands of the seas. And then again, up until Pearl Harbor, one of our greatest inputs came from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
A magnificent input. And did a great job for us. Now, on the continent of Europe, they had Norwegians and the Danes and the Dutch and the French that were able to escape and get out. And then, of course, they were there from Poland and Czechoslovakia. And so it went. So we had, as I say, about 7 or 8 different nationalities on any one parade. So very widely, they came from all over the earth. And now the astonishing thing is, you'll appreciate this, we have a reunion every 4 years about, and the last one was in Winnipeg, and we had one addition. We had some people from Germany, including their greatest ace in that war, came to the meeting.
Oh, who was that? Galen, was his name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Galen.
Yeah.
So that and there's another. This is the fourth year. There'll be another one there this fall in Winnipeg. And we had over. We had about 1,000 from the New Zealand and Australia. Many of those New Zealanders married Canadian girls, you know, and took them home, and now they all want to come home about every 4 years. So this is the and they get special treatment. So I thought you'd be interested in that. Well, I don't know what I'm going to give you a lot of this. There's so much of it, it could take too much time.
Okay. Did you have anything to do with the training of specialist ground staff, armed officers?
Our own.
Your engineers?
Everything.
You have to do the whole...
bag of tricks.
Yeah. But only the ones you used yourself, not to send elsewhere.
What do you mean about that?
Well, for instance, you trained air crew and they went off somewhere else. Well, did you train officers or communications?
We trained our... we had to... Except for those key people that we'd... had finished their training before the war broke out. After the war broke out, England was completely unable to send us anything at all except raw material. And she sent her troops as a candidate. But we ourselves set up our own schools, and they functioned all through the war.
Yes. Yeah, you do have to have supply officers, quartermasters, and the whole thing.
Whole bag of tricks.
As well as not only the doctors, but the other hospital administrators, I suppose.
Well, we had a special school set up by... Banting, and then he was killed in the forces of Newfoundland.
Yeah.
Banting was one of the chief ones who set it up. And the medical school was called, it was set up in Toronto. What the devil was the name of it? Anyway, aviation medicine.
Yes. Were any of these specialist schools under your command at number 4? Strictly all air crews.
Not the main ones. The main ones have been set up largely in places like Trenton and in Ontario and Toronto, where the great bulk of the population funneled anyway.
But you set up your own staff call, little staff school.
I wouldn't call that one of the main ones. We set up our own,
your own, yes.
Once in a while. I set up a half a dozen little smaller ones, using my own troops, and putting our own troops through our own school, our best instructors. But we only put enough through there to meet our own demands, because we didn't want to depend on whatever came out of there, and have people sending us what we thought we needed, because they never sent us what we wanted. I learned that lesson very early in 1939 and 40. I set up my first school of this kind in Moose Jaw on fire instructors. And I used about a half a dozen of my best instructors and got them ready for it. At that time, they wouldn't let us grade them. A1, A1, A2, and then A, and then down to B1, B. They wouldn't let us do the grading. They wanted to do the grading right across Canada.
Oh,
every time I'd send them down to Ottawa, after I'd get them nicely trained, down to Trenton, their main school, they'd grab my best people and say, "Oh, we know better than he knows." And I'd get back any refuse, the ones that weren't the lowest in the class. Well, I'd get back, plus some of their chaff, which I didn't want at all.
So it's all the way, isn't it, really?
Not necessarily.
It happened in other services, too.
But the main thing was for me to set up my own schools by myself and then put my best material in and keep them in. But they didn't know about it. They didn't know in time. And by the time they did know, it didn't matter, because he'd been probably promoted up higher and he'd been falling in the category.
Right.
So we set up many... Well, the flying instructor school, but I forced them to acknowledge that. I demanded that we were able to grade our own, and we did.
Well, first by the spring, or late spring, in May and June, I guess, of 1944, the air recruiting for air crew and ground personnel ceased in the RCAF.
That's right.
You were putting through more than you really needed. And by October, there actually began a reduction of personnel,
that's right.
Relief centers were set up to let out
officers. That is true. Late in 44.
Yeah.
At that time, Tubby Power and Bednar decided that I would move to Ottawa, mm-hmm. and they said I was in charge of the a planning committee to take care of the setting up the post-war organizational arrangements.
Well, were you still in command in November of 44 when number 4 training command was disbanded? Or had you moved out before that?
I moved out in the autumn, early autumn.
Oh, so actually before it was somebody else looked after the actual disbanding of that command?
Yes. There was a slowdown. I was there for part of the slowdown,
yeah.
But not for the finish of the slowdown and not for the disbandment.
So finally, what really was happening, finally, that the supply was certainly outstripping the requirements or the casualties that we were suffering in flying operations. Essentially,
well, Hiroshima, Hiroshima, however you
pronounce it. We're talking about November 44, in the summer of 1944.
That is true.
When they began to let these...
Well, because they didn't disband quite too many then.
The plan didn't wind up, I realize, until the spring of 45. Yes.
They'd already built up a tremendous number of people in the supply in England,
yeah.
And that is it's clogging back the machinery.
Right, yes.
So they started letting out, well, air crew, for example, graduated, but they were let them right out in the autumn of the 44, and they were...
Straight discharge
before they went overseas.
They could have transferred them to the Army. The Army is perennially short of...
Well, they weren't trained for the Army.
No, I know, okay.
I know the Army had about 40,000 people here in D.C. that
I know.
Wouldn't go overseas.
Yeah.
Well, but you had a lot of people. Why didn't you take them send them over to the guidance whether they wanted to go or not? You didn't see if you fed them and trained them and clothed them for ages, and then you just let them go.
That's right, yeah.
Well,
just one more thing, going back to 1943, when the air cadets were formed, did that have any effect on your command? You had to provide some facilities or officers to look after that or not?
The air cadets are quite a story. Did I tell you about that?
No, you haven't.
Oh, well, you see, the Army cadets have been going for a very long time, and the Army cadets. I was an Army cadet in, at the beginning of 1914-15 before I went into the Army. That's how I went through the cadet. But then the Navy, of course, they had their good cadets. They'd set up in War One. But the Air Force were never able to get any money for it because the Army needed all the money and the Navy. So Ottawa looked very tatter, whatever you want to call it, looked dimly on any... Well, they couldn't supply the money for their own requirements. So we started ourselves an air cadet training arrangement sub rosa before about 1939, and there were two set up in Canada, one here in the West Coast in Vancouver, and another one at Trinity College School in Port Hope, and that's where air crew started wearing a tartan Scottish tartan.
Oh really?
That's
really?
Where it started. At Port Hope,
that's
at Trinity College. Well, but as soon as the war broke out, we were separated, made our own. Ottawa was very keen about it then, too late. They were always keen, but they couldn't do anything. Now, then it spread right across Canada. And by 1943 and 44, I had about 4,000 air cadets in my command. And furthermore, I had the privilege of one of the early graduating classes in 1941 of air cadets said he'd gotten through by that time, late 41, early 42, I can't give you the exact date, graduating class, but he, one of them, of the group that went over, won himself a distinguished flying cross on a bombing raid, and I'd had the pleasure of pinning his wings on him when he graduated as an air cadet as a pilot, and he came back to he got wounded and came back to his home, and we had him in my own command by 43.
Very nice, yeah, yeah. So he was one of the early ones.
He was one of our earliest ones.
Yeah.
By 40,
generally speaking, it wasn't organized across Canada until 1943.
By 41, we were into it. And by 42, we were into a bigger lot.
I'm not talking about the university there. I'm talking about the 15-year-old and...
Anywhere from 12 to 18.
Yeah, okay,
12 to 18.
Yeah,
and
right.
The one I'm telling about came from a little town called Assiniboine.
Mm-hmm.
It's right down the south of Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
It's only a
mm-hmm.
tiny village, and this young fellow had to ride a mule or whatever to school about 6 or 7 miles. And in addition to that, he found a time to be in the Air Cadets, and I went down to the graduating pass, and the mothers and fathers were so proud of their kids that he'd ridden to school in the wintertime, in the cold prairie winter, and here going on doing this thing. It's just worth its weight in gold.
They generally had their local headquarters at one of your air stations? Provide a staff officer for them or some sort of training officer?
We did everything we could. Just hold that off.
Here we are again. Okay.
We could give you a quick summary, a condensation. It won't be absolutely complete because that'll take too long, but the plan reached its actual peak of its work at the close of 1943, when 73 BCATP, British Common Air Training Plan, and 24 RAF flying training schools and 184 other ancillary units in Canada were in operation, with a trained staff of 104,113, and 91,289 of these service, and 12,824 were civilian. So our staff both service in uniform, and we had a good civil staff trained too. And over 15,000 more were in training for staff positions. And every month, more than 3,000 trained aircrew were being added to the RAF, the RCAF, the RAAF, Australian, of course, and the RNZAF, New Zealand. Early in the following year, by the Power of Balfour Agreement of February 44, it was arranged, in view of the large reserve of aircrew already trained or under instruction, many of these, of course, are in Great Britain, to begin gradual reduction of the schools and pupil intake. In October 44, the closing of the schools was accelerated, and by the end of the year, the number of the BCATP schools had been reduced to 50, and those of the RAF to 2. On March the 29th, 1945, the final wings parades were held across Canada, and 2 days later, the BCATP was officially terminated as scheduled. Prime Minister Churchill, in a message to Prime Minister King, expressed congratulations on the successful accomplishment of a spacious task imaginatively conceived and most faithfully carried out. I don't think I need to go further into the detail, unless you want it.